This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, do I have a great book for you today. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Jonathan Santlaffer, who is an artist and an author. And it is just a joy to welcome you back, Jonathan.
Hi, Patsy. How are you? Treat to hear you again.
Oh, wow, Jonathan, what can I say? This is Becher. You know, it was meant to be that you would write a book about the lost Van Gogh.
Yeah, I think it was. You know, I've loved Van Gogh since I was a boy, and not that I thought about putting him in a book, but it sort of just worked its way in, and I think it's been the most fun and interesting writing experience I've had so far.
Well, it is also fun for the reader because there's so much, and there are so many complex issues in this book. And when we get into it and we're reading it, you know, of course you are an artist, so you're looking at it from the artist's point of view, but you bring it to life, you bring the story, which I really found so fascinating. And you also bring back the characters from The Lost Mona Lisa, because everybody who read that book fell in love with those characters, Luc Peroni, and of course, the Interpol analyst. I just, the minute I read about him in that book, Jonathan Washington Smith, I think I said to you in that interview, my gosh, you have to bring him back.
You know, that's funny because I love that character. And I would say that The Last Mona Lisa is kind of Luc Peroni's book. He kind of, you know, he's the voice and he's the main protagonist. His girlfriend, Alexis Verde, who is more than his girlfriend, a brilliant art historian. And then John Washington Smith, you know, I kind of created him after interviewing a retired Interpol art analyst. And I think he kind of, in a way, runs off with The Lost Van Gogh, with this book. And I let him have it. You know, he started taking the book and he risks his life to, for many reasons, as you know, it is a complex story that deals with stolen art, Nazi-looted art, goes back and forth in time between, you know, the time when Van Gogh painted the painting at the very end of his life to the very end of World War II, those little snippets of the past that go through that show the reader and bring the reader through this route that this painting took as it got lost and then found and then lost again.
Well, you've created a mystery here for us because this story, although it was in the art world about a lost Van Gogh, I mean, it was like this was made for you. It was like, wow, you know, to have the idea here. So tell us about, well, of course, you had the marvelous, wonderful opportunity to travel and to visit the sites and to go to, you know, the location. So tell us about, I mean, that must have been so exciting.
Oh, you know, Patsy, that is always, for me, the most fun. You know, I believe pretty much you really can't write about a place unless you go there, because you don't really understand the scale of a city or a town. You don't understand what it feels like, what it smells like. So for this book, you know, I went to Amsterdam, of course. I spent time in the Van Gogh Museum. I spent time in the Anne Frank house behind the scenes in both of those places. I also went to Auvers-sur-Oise, France, which is the last place that Van Gogh lived. You know, he lived in this small French town for 70 days, and he made 75 paintings in 70 days, so more than a painting a day. And they're all great, you know, and there's the whole mystery surrounding Van Gogh's death. Some people think they know what happened. I think there's a lot of mysterious things around Van Gogh's death. But the travel was just fantastic. You know, I did that also for the last Mona Lisa. I went and stayed for several weeks in the Piazza de Madonna. I Airbnb'd an apartment, which is where Luke is staying when he goes to Florence. So these are the perks and the wonderful part of writing these historical fiction novels, where I take something that's true and then play with it and, you know, invent kind of this fascinating thriller around it, you know. So that's kind of my fun and what I do with it.
And of course, it's tax deductible, and the IRS cannot question the expenses, because you had to do this traveling, and you had to eat the food, and you had to stay in the places, and all they have to do is read the book to see that you really did deep research.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's not a joke. I mean, yes, it's tax deductible. Not so much your food, Patsy, because you are expected to eat everywhere, so you can't really deduct most of your food. But the travel is deductible for, you know, and I say that in a very serious way. I always go where, I mean, even if it's in New York or if it's in, you know, upstate New York, wherever I set something, I want to be there. I want to feel it. I think it really makes the book authentic. And you know, Patsy, I'm sure if you know your city and somebody's writing about it and they make a mistake, you think, uh-oh, boy, they were lazy. They didn't bother to come and figure it out, right?
Exactly. And with you, of course, you stand in the locations that you're writing about. And I was, of course, I lived in Europe for many years, so I did a lot of traveling. Much of it was exactly based on where either authors lived or where artists lived, because those are the subjects that I was interested in. So, and battlefields, for my husband.
Oh, really?
If there was a battlefield nearby, I could get him to take me anywhere.
I love that.
So
I
was lucky. Europe does not lack battlefields. So, so he got his military fun and I got all my artistic and literary fun out of those travels. And until you go to these places, until you stand in front of Van Gogh's grave with his brother, all of this touches you so much and sort of imbues the story with reality.
Oh, I totally agree. You know, you talk about standing in front of Van Gogh's grave. You know, he's buried in Auvers-sur-Oise, in this little town. It's about an hour north of Paris. And the cemetery is the town cemetery. It's very modest. And you just stand in front of this plot, and Vincent and his brother Theo are buried next to each other, and it's so touching. And, you know, his younger brother Theo was an art dealer who really supported Vincent most of his life, and he died 6 months later. And they are buried side by side in this little town, and, you know, there are their gravestones, you know, with ivy growing over them, and then you walk 2 minutes and you're at the cathedral that Van Gogh painted and made famous. And then you walk another 2 minutes and you can go into the auberge where Van Gogh lived. And you climb up this winding staircase to the attic. And here is this tiny room. It's like a monk's cell, Patsy. And this is where probably one of the most famous artists who ever lived spent the last 70 days of his life, in this tiny, modest room. It's really touching. And it tells you a lot about the man. Plus, you then walk around and see the countryside and see where he painted. And that became, for me, something that, you know, helped influence the parts of the book that deal with Van Gogh. There's much else, as you know, in the book about this painting that got lost that just happens to be one of the last Van Gogh self-portraits.
Well, you know, I know the location so well. As I said, we traveled Europe, and we had a white Cadillac in those days, a white Cadillac.
I love it.
And my husband always wore a cowboy hat.
I wish I were in the back seat with you guys.
Well, it was just wonderful, and of course, we made quite a sensation coming into town. And one of the things we had, you know, we of course bought local food, and we had a picnic. And I read some of the I just get tears in my eyes. I read some of the letters that Vincent wrote. And my husband, you know, loved art, but he had never read any of those. And I just felt that urge. I needed to read some of them out loud. And it does break your heart when you think that Theo really died of a broken heart himself, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think, well, there's so many, you know, things that were going on. I mean, Theo was actually unwell for a lot of his life, but in fact, I do think his heart was broken when Vincent died. They had a very, very close relationship. And as you just said, they wrote continual letters. Vincent was this inveterate, you know, letter writer. He wrote over 2,000 letters in his life, many to his brother. And you can read them. And as you say, they are heartbreaking. They're informative. You know, Vincent talks about what he's doing, his artwork, his mental state, you know, his moods, his loves, they're amazing. You know, I started the book, though, Patsy, with a different letter, a letter written by a young artist friend of Vincent Van Gogh's who had been at his funeral. So Vincent died at 37, and in France, in this little town, and his brother came, of course, and they laid him out in what is the now really the restaurant from this auberge in the center of town, surrounded his head with yellow and golden flowers, and they tacked on the walls a lot of his last paintings. And in the letter that his friend Emile Bernard wrote to another friend, he describes the funeral so that I could use it if I wanted to, and he describes the paintings. And he mentions a painting that nobody has ever seen again. So the question becomes, was he inadvertently making a mistake? Was he talking about a different painting? Or did that painting disappear? And that got me going, Patsy. You know, like, what happened to, or what could have happened to that painting? And that's really what I'm not going to ruin it because you don't find out really until the end of the book about that. There are other things you learn as you go along, but what really, how that painting, if that painting existed and left Van Gogh's funeral, you find out rather late in the book. So that was exciting to play with the idea of it. And let me just say the other idea that I was excited to, the fantasy of going to a flea market, you know, spending $25, $5, buying a painting that turns out to be something extraordinary. So that was another thing that I used to in my head for this book, as you know. Patsy, you there? I think I've lost you. What happened? Huh.
I'm sorry. Oh. Do you hear me?
I didn't for a while.
Okay. Well, that idea, the idea that you had here of finding something in a flea market, I will tell you, as I was reading it, it reminded me of a story of a lady from New Orleans who told me that one time she did see, and she didn't know at the time, she is sure that she saw a Degas.
Wow.
But she didn't buy it because the person, you know, who had it said, oh, well, he was a local artist. So she thought, well, you know, a local artist is not worth anything. But now after, you know, 30 years later, she looks back and she says, I think that really was a Degas.
Oh, wow.
And you know, you never know. So that's what I did. I actually bought for $50 an amazing lithograph that turned out to be from 1814, and I got it for $25 from a you know. So you never know.
You know, I when I bought this little old farmhouse in upstate New York, the people who were selling it, the people who had owned it before them, the woman was an art dealer from Germany. And they showed me, they said, oh, you know, look, there were these paintings and drawings we found in the attic. Do you think they're worth anything? And I looked at one of them and I said, this is a German expressionist painting from the 30s, I would guess, or 40s, and you have to bring this to an auction house. And it did turn out to be a very valuable painting. I think they should have given me the house for free after that, but no, they didn't. But anyhow, you know, it does happen.
Well, you, with Luke and his girlfriend, let's talk a little bit about Luke Peroni, his background, because that's fascinating. And of course, it all comes out in the Mona Lisa, but here in this, it's as relevant for his interest in art and also, of course, Alexis and her understanding of art.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Luke and Alex, as her nickname, they share a sort of odd commonality in their background, because Luke, his great-grandfather was Vincenzo Perugia, the name was changed to Peroni, and Vincenzo Perugia stole the Mona Lisa in 1911. That's a true story, and that is the story that sparked the last Mona Lisa, Luke going back to look for his great-grandfather's prison diary. And Alex's father is a big-time art thief. So these two people have this sort of crazy background that they share and come together unexpectedly in the last Mona Lisa. And then in this book, The Lost Van Gogh, they're living together. You know, I do think the books, it's interesting when you have continuing characters, because I want these books to totally stand alone. I've heard from people who read The Lost Van Gogh first and then went back and read The Last Mona Lisa, and they said, no, it was fine. I just learned more. And that's what I hope, you know, that will happen. And I feel the same about John Washington Smith. You know, we learn things about him in both books, his background, how he grew up, what his life was about, how he became an Interpol agent, and, you know, how he gets involved in these cases and with Luke. So these three characters they're kind of living inside my head, Patsy, and they keep whispering things to me, so I listen to them, you know. Yep. Luke and Alex. So, Patsy, every once in a while, I lose you, it seems, on our connection.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I was going to say that the three characters have led you on the most wonderful journey through the world and through, their travels, of course. But let's talk a little bit about the art world, because really what you do here, you make... for people who aren't artists and or don't have a background, they don't need to, because you lay it out so easily and with so much fun, whether it's explaining who the post-impressionists were, just simple things. I always love when a book teaches you something, when at the end of it, even years later, you're thinking about something or you hear a word and you hear post-impressionist, well, you're going to think of Jonathan Sandlauer.
Oh, well, I love that. You know, I also love to learn things in books, but when I'm writing my books, I never think, oh, I'm teaching. I don't want to be, didactic. I never want to preach to people. But I do think that the information you give to people should be fun and illuminating, make them want to look more. People always tell me that when they're reading my books, they then look things up on the internet to see them, to see the Van Goghs, to see, these other places or paintings or artworks. I always say to people, no artwork gets into my book unless it has to do with the story and moves the story forward. I think it can be really fun and exciting. Art theft is like the number three crime in the world, according to the FBI and the CIA and Interpol. I mean, it's just billions of dollars annually. It's this huge, huge, huge crime network. Artwork is stolen, used as barter for drugs and arms. It's just crazy. But my research has taken me to all of these different aspects of, I would say, let's call it the underbelly of the art world, what happens on the dark web with stolen paintings. The particular painting that I deal with in The Lost Van Gogh, of course, and I don't think it ruins anything to say that we discover it was a Nazi-looted painting during the war. And that led me to a tremendous amount of research, all of which was fascinating and is very much in the news nowadays because of art, restitution. And what does a museum do when they find out a painting was stolen? And, it's a very big moral question for museums and collectors and all of that,
Well, that's why the book is complex, as I said, a lot of twists and turns, and you have all these different layers, and this idea of course, restitution and what the Germans stole, that all plays into the storyline. And of course, the dark side of the art world, which is something that you are familiar with, because I have to tell people when I say that Jonathan is an artist, Jonathan is a really big time artist. His work has been shown all over the place. And one of the things that you come to this, to writing, actually from first being an artist, and it was a big tragedy that brought you to writing. Everybody always asks me, find out from an author, how did they start writing? Was it their teacher who said, start writing or whatever? And I said, in your case, it was a real, real full-time, big-time tragedy that led you to become an author.
Well, that's true. I have a lot of things to say about that. I'll say them quickly. So, yeah, I was and still am a painter, and I was doing that very, very seriously. And this goes back 25 years ago, Patsy, but a retrospective exhibition was planned for 10 years of my work. They collected paintings from museums and collectors, and then my newest six paintings, and they were all put in this exhibition, and the show opened on a Friday night. And Saturday, the very next day, the building burned down to the ground. So 10 years of my work went up in smoke overnight. Now, I do want to say, after I picked myself up off the floor, looking back at that, I want to say that nobody died. So, one has to keep that in perspective. And I don't recommend a fire, but it changed my life in an extraordinary way because I didn't expect to be a writer. I was going to stay on course with my painting. And You know, I went to Rome. I was invited to the American Academy in Rome soon after that fire. I went there with my wife and my 8-year-old daughter and lived there. But I had trouble painting because my mind was a mess from that fire. So I started a novel, and that's how I actually started writing seriously. So it's very fascinating to me that when we get bumped off course, you know, what can happen to us. I mean, looking back at it, it's it actually gave me a second life. I've had two parts to my life, and I'm not sorry about it. I'm really not. So,
well, another Beshert. And the result was The Death Artist. And one of the intriguing things with that book is that you do have, you've got to use some of your artistic talents. And this has been sort of a part of your writing that you've included. Yeah. And even in the new book, you put in some of your artwork.
Well, you know, whenever I go somewhere for research, I do drawings. So, you know, so let's say this time, you know, I went to Amsterdam and Auvers-sur-Oise, and it's sort of in my head because I went to art school and it's the way I see the world sort of in pictures. So, you know, I did drawings of Van Gogh and Theo's grave and of the cathedral, and I did drawings of Van Gogh, and I made copies of his self-portraits. And then my editor knew I did this, that I kept these little sketchbooks, and she looked at them and she said, oh, let's put some in the book. And they're at the end of the book. They're a kind of coda. But, you know, I do this a lot. And the way I write is I think I'm a very visual writer, and because of my training, because I need to see the scene in my head so that I can write it. I'm kind of walking or running or racing through a scene as I write it. You know, I'm actually seeing it and experiencing it because of my training, I'd say. So, you know, one of my books, Anatomy of Fear, is about a police sketch artist, Nate Rodriguez, and I created him originally so that I could do his police sketches in the book, which I did, and I actually went and worked with police sketch artists, and I even was interviewed by police who had me sketch, you know, criminals in front of an audience. That was wild, and I was pretty good at it. So, yeah, I mean, I think my background in art has helped me in many ways. I mean, also just the discipline of art school. Nobody knows this, but art school, unless you go to art school, is very, very disciplined. There's tons of hours put in of work. And that helped me to be a writer because you have to be disciplined. You know, nobody forces you to sit down and write, you know, Patsy.
Exactly. You know, and so now not only are you an author and an artist with the new book, you're also a bit of a detective, which is fun because it sort of reminded me a little bit of, you know, it is so great when an author comes out with an idea, something will click. They hear a subject. It's like I recently Douglas Brunt came out with a wonderful book about Rudolf Diesel, and it all came just from one little thing that happened. He bought an old boat, and the guy at the dock said, "Well, you should use a diesel engine," and he didn't know anything about diesel. So it's part of the fun of being a writer that you jump into these things and then they do consume you. As you said, with your three main characters, I mean, they take on a life of their own. And you do have various points of view in the book, which is not always easy. But when you have three characters like this, it's a pretty exciting thing to write.
Yeah, you know, in the last Mona Lisa and in this book, The Lost Van Gogh, the structure is very similar. That is, there's a story in the past, and then the main story is in the present, but you go back to the past. And you're right, there are different points of view. Luke, whenever Luke is, and he's the main character, he's written in the first person, and everybody else is in the third person. So I go back and forth. I try and make this as seamless as I can, and so the reader's not aware of it, but it's fun for me because when you're in the third person, You can see everything that's going on. When you're in the first person, Luke's point of view, all you can see is what Luke is seeing and experiencing. And that is, so the two points of view are really fun for me to work with as I write. You know, going back to you saying how, you know, it's like when somebody discovers something that somehow touches them or excites them and becomes their hobby or becomes something they want to do with their life. You know, this happens to me. I mean, the last Mona Lisa, I don't know, I think a lot of people knew, but I had not known that the Mona Lisa had actually been stolen out of the Louvre Museum in 1911 and was missing for 2 years. And that story, like, just, I became obsessed with it, and I did a lot of research, and that, you know, got me going on that novel. And with this one, you know, it was what happened after Van Gogh died with this painting, plus the whole restitution issue, the whole Nazi art stealing. You know, the Nazis stole one-fifth of the art of Europe. I mean, it's kind of astonishing. And there are known to be over 100,000 artworks still missing and that are not accounted for. The Nazis kept they kept records of the artworks they were stealing. So we know what they took. You know, the monuments men came in after the war, and artwork was returned to the country of origin, not to individuals. That group was disbanded too early. And now today, we still, I mean, right this week, there are two Egon Schiele paintings up for auction that had been stolen and are now, you know, up for sale in retribution. When I went to Amsterdam, I met this woman whose grandfather owned Van Gogh's Dr. Gachet, one of the portraits of Dr. Gachet, who was treating Van Gogh. And she has been fighting for 20 years to get recognition that her grandfather owned the painting. She has all kinds of documentation. And so this is an ongoing thing. But these two subjects kind of collided for me in my mind, and I just followed them and to write this book and to create this story. I wanted it to be super exciting. That's always, you know, I want my own excitement to help fuel the book and then get the reader excited, you know?
Well, you do that. And definitely with this whole art world and art thieves, you've got a lot of material ahead of you. And I suspect that we're going to be seeing a lot more of John Washington Smith and Luke and Alex, because you've got a lot of material to work with.
Yes, I do. I mean, you know, it's funny because stories are just, it's as if, you know, this happens in your life, Patsy, I'm sure. You know, you start becoming interested in something, and then it's like the universe sends you more information. It's fate. So I do. In fact, I'm sort of started a third book, which I hadn't quite expected, and I'm excited about that one as well. Yeah, we can say, fortunately for me and unfortunately for the world, art theft is a huge thing that is wild and very often very dark, but exciting. So these stories come to me. There are ones in the past and then ones in the present, and I get to play with and try and figure out how to construct them into one story, one exciting story. Yeah.
Well, I think that it's not quite as dark as some of your first books were very dark, because you had a lot of murders.
I have to say that, like, The Lost Van Gogh, these books are historical fiction, and I've just, you know, I sort of decided there was enough, let's say, murder and darkness in the world, so I didn't want to add too much to that in a certain way. So I have killed a lot less people on the page, and I'm more interested in the exciting search and hunt for these things now, you know, so very different kind of books. And that's fun for me, you know? So, yeah.
Definitely. Funny. Because I think in The Death Artist, I don't remember how many people got killed in The Death Artist, but
A lot.
A lot of people. But you were in a dark place at the time.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because it's somewhat true, but I also saw The Death Artist as a kind of, now you won't believe this, as a sort of funny book, you know, a serial killer in the New York art world who was killing artists and art dealers and curators. And you know, I thought I was very over the top, and I found it a little bit sort of funny. And then People Magazine, the reason that book got so successful, I think, is People Magazine called it like one of the scariest books of the year, and they chose it as the thriller of the week.
I know.
You know, so I was like, I was bowled over. I couldn't believe it. So, and people still like that book. It was my first novel. It feels like a long, long time ago. So, yeah, The Lost Mango is my seventh novel. I've written 8 books, but it's my seventh novel. So,
yeah, but they were right about The Death Artist because it is a scary book. But I also appreciated the sort of tongue in cheek because I've been working now for over 20 years on a book, or a film script about killing lawyers and producers. I was involved in a lot when I was very young. And I was in Hollywood and my work was stolen. I did a lawsuit against a major film company. Now, you don't do that when you're young and and you're a lawyer. It just got, you know, graduated and got through the bar, and he's wearing a Sears and Roebuck suit. You don't sue a major studio.
No, probably not, because they have a lot more high-powered lawyers there.
Also,
they're going to not, you know, they're going to hurt your work. They're going to keep you out, I would imagine,
They do. So that's why I can appreciate killing off a lot of people. But I am happy that the three of them are going to be coming back because they're great. And I know that we're going to have fun with them. And you've been having, I think, some fun with the way that you have promoted your book in a very intriguing way. I don't know how much is still going on, but you actually were giving away some of your artwork.
Yes. I've been giving away, I made a print of one of my drawings, limited edition. I've been giving that away. And there was a contest to win one of my drawings, a portrait of Van Gogh. Because, you know, I prefer to give these things out into the world. And certainly I appreciate my readers. So that's fun for me. And, you know, I've been on the road, Patsy, for a couple of weeks now, at least from city to city. At bookstores and different venues talking about this and talking with, you know, other writers talking with me. And that's great, great fun. A little exhausting, but great fun. And you know, the good news is that The Lost Mango has been on the USA Today bestseller list for 2 weeks, which is really great for the first 2 weeks that it came out. So that's exciting. I love to give my artwork away, that, you know, these sketches and things that I do, because otherwise, you know, they gather dust and I'd rather somebody have them and appreciate them. Right?
And it certainly creates fans and people who will talk about you, and promote your book. So it does so many things, and isn't it wonderful that the pandemic is over and that you can do this kind of traveling again?
Oh my gosh. Yes. You know, the last Mona Lisa came out during the pandemic, and I couldn't travel anywhere. So it was all virtual, and they were wonderful. But, you know, going somewhere, meeting people who read your books or are interested is just so great. It's just a different thing, you know. I like the virtual things also because you get to have people, you know, from all over, you know, who can't get to a live event. But it's really true. I mean, I just came home from Scottsdale, Poison Pen Bookstore, and before that I was at New Orleans and Octavia Books, and in Houston at Murder by the Book, and what am I forgetting? I'm in New York at McNally Jackson. I was in conversation with Joyce Carol Oates, and then This Saturday, I'm going to Woodstock, New York, which will be fun, with the writer Allison Galen. I like, as I said, I like dragging my friends, writer friends, in to talk with me at these events. I think it's more fun for the you know, the readers and the people who come to the events. So it's really great to do it. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to get out there, you know, in the world and meet readers, which is wonderful. And these bookstore, you know, bookstore owners are so fun and really great.
And they really need that kind of support to keep their bookstores alive, because there aren't enough of them. And it really gives them a lot to work with when an author shows up and they can promote it and people remember it. And the authors remember them, because, you know, for an author, you live a very solitary life when you're working, when you're writing. It's, you know, day after day writing. It's good for you to get out and to, I think, getting a compliment in person is worth 10,000 compliments on Zoom.
You are absolutely right. And, you know, because being a writer or a painter, or, you know, it's a very solitary occupation. It's a solitary life. People think of it as glamorous or exciting. No, it's not. You know, I'm sitting in a chair behind a computer half my days. I was telling people just the other night in Phoenix that what I do, because when I'm writing, it's so intense, as I jump out of my chair periodically, I run to the back of my loft and I do a drawing, because it's physical. It's something I know I can do. It's fun. But I do spend a lot of my time alone. And so it's really great to be that other, you know, that other part of yourself, you know, that is outgoing and gets to meet people and talk to people. And I've had a great time on my book tour. Despite being on an airplane every single day in a different city, which is a little much, meeting people and talking to them is just, there's nothing like it, you know, and hearing what they have to say about your books or how it touched their lives. It's extraordinary, Patsy. It really is.
I want to go back for just a few minutes to talk about Amsterdam, because Amsterdam is a place where I spent a lot of time. It brings back so many memories. So tell us a little bit about where you stayed in Amsterdam, and what did you think of the museum?
Oh, I loved Amsterdam. You know, I went for many reasons, of course, but because it's, you know, where Van Gogh spent much of his life. And I stayed in a little hotel right near the Museum Plaza, you know, the Van Gogh Museum, the Rijksmuseum. All of these museums are in one spot in Amsterdam, and I stayed like two blocks away, so I could easily get up in the morning and walk over to the museum. So I spent a couple of days, more than that, at the Van Gogh Museum. I went behind the scenes. I had time alone there, but I would do sketches of Van Gogh's self-portraits, and they have amazing things. Like, they have one of his palettes and some of his paintbrushes in a case and squeezed out tubes of paint. Extraordinary. And then the Rijksmuseum, I got to stand in front of Rembrandt's Night Watch for a long time, and I used it in the book. So I put it in a scene with Luke is there. And I use the art. As I said, it has to have a reason. It has to move the story forward, but also as a way to a kind of metaphor for something, like in the Night Watch, the civilians defending their city, which was something John Washington Smith was doing in a way, or people were doing in Holland, in Amsterdam, when they were occupied by the Nazis. So there was, Amsterdam was, it's a beautiful city. I made friends there. I stayed there for several weeks, so I made some new Dutch friends. My book is coming out in Dutch in April, and I think I'm going to go back and see my new friends there.
Oh, you have to. You have to be there for that, because they will love it. They will appreciate it. And as as you said, Amsterdam is so wonderful. We spent a lot of time there. We were always so. We did the smaller places too, especially the restaurants. You can go down a street in Amsterdam, and then you find just this sort of little hole in the wall restaurant. You walk in, and it's a family restaurant, a real family restaurant. Right. And they just welcome you, and they take care of you, and they do become friends.
Yeah, you know, what happened to me was so wonderful and odd. Friends of friends, they put me in touch with Dutch friends. And these Dutch friends, I mean, they were not my friends, but they invited me. It was Easter Sunday. They had a boat going through the canals of Amsterdam, and they invited me, and they had a band and wine, and it was so much fun going through these canals. And I was talking to many, you know, there were probably 25 people on this boat, and I was talking to this guy, and we got to be, you know, chatty and friendly, and he said, I own this little bar, this Café Dispute. And he said, come with me after the boat ride. So I went there and had a drink with him and another one of his friends. And I ended up using his bar, the Café Dispute, in my novel. So, you know, these things happen. The Dutch were so welcoming. But, you know, I have found that wherever I go, people have been really warm and welcoming. I found that, you know, when I spent time in, well, I love Italy. I lived in Rome for almost a year, and you know, I'm always happy in Italy, but I love to travel. And so it's always, you know, I met an artist in Florence who got me into the prison, which was closed, where Vincenzo Perugia, the man who stole the Mona Lisa, was imprisoned. And I got to get myself locked into a cell so I could feel what that was like. I mean, it was pretty crazy, I'll tell you, Patsy, but I was afraid, gosh, my Italian's not good at all. Are they going to let me out of this cell? But, you know, I got to use it in the book. So these things are, you know, yeah, well, that's Amsterdam.
That's one of the wonderful things about being a published author. If you can go look, and you say, you know, I'm an author, this is my book, does open doors for you. It is absolutely fantastic how willing people are to share their stories about their locations and about people they knew.
Yeah. You know, also, it's funny, because the last Mona Lisa came out during the pandemic, I got so many emails and letters from people thanking me for taking them to Florence and to Paris during the pandemic. Because, you know, one of the things is that you get to travel in my books, and that, you know, I take you along with me on my, in a very intimate way, to these places. And for me, that's like, you know, I love that when I'm reading a book and I can really feel like I'm in a place with that author. And
well, I'm still planning to join you in Paris.
Okay, let's do it.
Where I understand you and I are going to sit at a table, a cafe, and be extras in the movie version of The Lost Mona Lisa.
Well, I hope so. I mean, there's talk about it. You know, these things are, you know, as you know, Hollywood, things happen, people get contact you, there's all this. Right now, there are discussions. Hopefully in the next few weeks, I will be able to say something about it.
Well, if you have breaking news, you must tell me and come on the program to announce it, because I don't get the opportunity for breaking news very often, but that would be breaking news.
I will. I'll tell you, you know, I've had so many of my books in pre-production or were optioned, and then the deals fell through.
All that
Hollywood story. So I don't give it, I never give Hollywood my heart. But,
you know, can't.
This one feels good, but, you know, we'll see.
You never know. I had three books optioned, three spec scripts optioned, and they appeared in the Hollywood Reporter. And in those days, I was young enough that I believed. I didn't understand about the turnaround. And then I didn't understand that somebody would actually steal one of them. So,
gosh,
you know, you live and learn.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
they should.
Yeah. I know.
They should
pay
attention to you because you have three wonderful characters, and that's the kind of property, as we would say in Hollywood. It's a property they can really make some streaming videos out of.
Well, you know, that's the interest right now, is a series, the either limited series or a continuing series. So we'll see, as I said, you know, and here's my story of heartbreak was Anatomy of Fear was already in pre-production for Fox on television. And then the writer's strike happened, a variety of things happened, and it fell apart. And then it went to Paramount, and it went somewhere else, and, you know, these things just happen. So
I know. I've been shopped around to a couple of different stations too. So I know. But meanwhile, you're having lots of fun with this great book, The Lost Van Gogh. It's available online. It's fantastic. And everyone, you should actually go to jonathansantloffer.com. That's his website. He has a wonderful, wonderful newsletter there. You sign up for his newsletter. You can also, he's got lots of photos of his travels and his artwork. And it's jonathansantloffer.com. It's a great website. So, Jonathan, again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. It is always a joy to talk to you. And seriously, if you have breaking news, break it here on Joy on Paper.
I will, Pastor. Thank you so much. It's always great to talk to you at Joy on Paper. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And right now I'm looking at one of your sketches, and I just... you know, when I met you at the Algonquin Hotel, I was going to tell you that, you know, I'm an artist too. I do, because I won a first prize for a watercolor once, and I thought, well, but I was so intimidated by you. You like,
oh no, don't be intimidated by me. No.
Well, you are a brilliant artist, just brilliant.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you,
and thank you,
anyone who's listening.
Oh, bye. Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye, Jonathan.
Bye.
Wow. What a guy. His book is tremendous. You must read it. It's just so much fun. I just, for anybody who, it's got so many aspects to it. The history, the art, the three characters who are really a trio of, fascinating possibilities. I think we will see them definitely in streaming videos. So get the books now. And this one is The Lost Van Gogh. Then you can get The Lost Mona Lisa. They're both standalone, but they go together and you will love them. Okay, bye-bye now. Say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. And I really hope that you will, if you have a question for our legal eagle, he's going to be on the program in a few weeks. Send it to me at patsy.radio@gmail.com. It is joymail. gmail.com. And I will have Bill Larson answer your intellectual property questions. Bye-bye now.